I do my show on the Heritage Radio Network because I think it's important to talk about the impact of technology on our lives.
I do my show to reach home cooks and help them do better.
Because I love getting together with people in the industry.
I like hosting my show because, to me, it's the stories about people and their relationship to food that help make the food more interesting and more delicious.
Our hosts do their shows as a labor of love, but we still need your financial support in order to keep the lights on and keep the tape rolling. Please become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by Union Beer. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is another special Cider Sessions edition. I'm Jimmy Carboni. We're broadcasting from Jimmy's number 43. This show will air sometime in the fall of 2015. Beer Sessions Radio is brought to you by Union Beer Distributors, supplier of world-class ales and ciders. Joining with me are Gay and Kay from United States of Cider and at Hello Cider on Twitter. Thanks, guys. Thanks for putting the show together. They do a great job. It seems like ever since Wassail opened on the Lower East Side, Gay and Kay are bringing in different cider people every week, so it's kind of been a treat, and we're putting together this whole new series. So, gentlemen, just go through and quickly introduce yourself, your names, and the cideries you work for, because there's two different cider guys here. So,
my name is Tim Prendergast, and I'm here with Ancho.
I'm Sam. I'm also here with Ancho. We're a small cidery and restaurant that's open in Washington, D.C. at the end of the year.
Cooper Sheehan with Ancho as well.
And Kyle Millstone.
Coffee Millstone in Maryland.
Yep, Millstone, Maryland.
So first, so you guys are here for something at Wassail. Is that what brought you to New York?
Yeah. So I had a cider dinner last night, and then we're doing our collaborative dinner, which is going to be with Stillwater and Oxbow Brewing. We did collaborations with both of them, and it's going to be a cool kind of melding of cider culture and beer culture.
So what is it about Wassail? I mean, it seems that every week some great cider people are coming into town now.
Wassail's kind of a beacon of light and hope for all things cider. I mean, I bend over backwards for them, as I will for Ancho when they open, because anyone that's preaching the gospel of real cider is, you know, just building a market that just is slowly growing, but, you know, more people that kind of are evangelizing it, the better.
Great, man. So I know you guys are at Millstone. We carry some of your product at Jimmy's number 43.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how you guys got started.
So it started with me and my father. We founded the company about 2011, started producing in 2012. My father used to be a winemaker, went to UC Davis for viticulture and winemaking. Was a winemaker in Maryland, Virginia during the 80s and 90s. I came from a completely different spectrum. Went to school for business, did some home brewing, but not really involved with much cider making. In fact, I would say didn't get into cider making because I like cider. I got into cider making because I liked what was coming out of Europe flavor-wise. I remember me and my father sat down. He had this old 18th century grist mill that he renovated and, you know, was working on rehabbing it for about 10 years. Hadn't done anything with it. I was like, you know, we should do something that kind of fits the history of the place. Let's do cider. It's a fast-growing market, and my business side kicking in. But past the business background, you know, we've been making rustic-style hard cider for the past 3.5 years, and since there wasn't much written on it, we're kind of writing the book as we go through. We started very simply. Everything we did was very much in the kind of natural style. We don't use sulfites. We don't pasteurize. Everything we do is oak barrel fermented, oak barrel aged, generally 6 to 8 months. It's aging on top of the lees the entire time. So just this funky rustic cider, very similar to what was being made 200 years ago.
That's great, man. Thanks for coming on the show. So a gentleman from my intro, tell us a little about what your project is and why you're here with Millstone.
We all come from beer backgrounds in Washington, D.C., but we discovered a really strong interest in cider a couple years ago through trying Kyle's products and also some of the international stuff that he had referenced. And so we are hoping to open at the end of the year as a restaurant, first and foremost, but we're also going to produce a small amount of cider. We're going to ask our good friend Kyle for some help in making sure that it comes out right. But beyond being a cidery, we're going to be the, I think, preeminent place to drink and buy cider in Washington, D.C.
So what's the first cider that we're tasting?
The first cider is, I think that we're actually drinking the other. We're drinking Bassa Haun, which is from a French Basque producer. Cooper and I actually were just there last month. In our opinion, this is our favorite international cider, I think, or producer at least.
Yeah.
This is their very dry product. We also have Bachandere, which is the female version. Also note that Ancho, our name comes from the same story as Bassa Haun. Both are the Basque wild man, kind of similar to Bigfoot. And this is his lady, Bachandere. So this producer every year takes, I believe it's 22 apples that they've identified themselves and cultivated. And then they sort them into more or less masculine and feminine flavor profiles. And every year they make these two products. So we're drinking Bassa Haun, which is the very dry version. This is maybe off-dry, but it has more sweetness to it, Bachandere. But I think they're really fantastic ciders. Do you want to talk a little bit about the flavor?
It's interesting when we go through and try both of them that the Bassa Haun that we're trying, they do actually bottle with a little bit of sugar. I think there's 10 grams per liter in it, and the Bachandere has twice the amount of sugar in it. So it's cool to be able to see. They both end up coming off not too sweet. It's nice to be able to contrast both of those. The thing that I like a lot about these ciders that I think not a lot of cider, specifically not a lot of American cider, brings to the table is the tannic character to it. It has really nice tannin to it, which gives it structure. It lengthens the finish out. I really love the tannin quality. And I like the Bachandere a little bit more. That's my favorite because it's the balance between tannin and sweetness that is like a really nice push and pull between one another. These are just fantastic products. I could drink these all the time.
There's a little bit of smokiness to it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
That can come from the apples themselves or from fermentation, from wild yeast fermentation. Oftentimes the wild yeast will kick out a little bit of more of a phenolic character, and that can range from a little bit of like a clove flavor all the way to like smokiness, or if it gets a little out of control, it comes up coming like a Band-Aid sort of aroma to it. But it's nice when you get that subtle smokiness to it. And I find that in Spanish cider, not infrequently. We're drinking a dessert cider from Asturias the other day that also had that really nice, pleasant smokiness to it.
So making a cider place in D.C., so is there no other real center for cider in D.C.? Isn't it the first place?
There are several places that have kind of, picked up. They might have two on draft at one time, and that's typically the most you'll see. Lots of bottle selections usually, but only large format, so only the people that already kind of know what they're looking for are ordering things like that. It's kind of our duty to try and expand people's sort of knowledge of cider in general by allowing people to try small quantities of tons of different things to find out what they like.
So D.C. is a different place. I know regulation-wise, I know that you can sell any beer in D.C. that's licensed in the United States. You know, unlike certain states, you have to go state by state. What's it like for you to import or sell ciders in D.C.? Is it kind of an open market?
It will be a fun opportunity for us. I mean, Tim and I at our old job at Meridian Pint, where we sold a lot of beer, we used to, I think we made kind of a name for ourselves by bringing beer out-of-market beer in. But essentially, if something's not available through distribution, we can bring it in ourselves. We have to register it and pay tax. But I'm not really sure what the intention of the law was originally, but the benefit now for the beverage scene is that we have a really diverse
selection. Just have to go through the federal. You don't have to deal with any additional state or...
We have to pay a small tax in D.C. I mean, you're supposed to go register the product, say that you're bringing it in, and pay for beer. It's $2.79 per barrel. So for every keg, it's like $1.30 they have to pay on it. You know, it's not a moneymaker for them. It's mostly just the pain of having to register it. But as long as another distributor doesn't carry it or warehouse it in D.C., then it's legal to bring it in, which is fantastic for our beverage scene.
That's like an amazing opportunity for you to take really small producers from all over the country and give them a showcase that they're not going to have.
You know, we could
else.
Just bring a case in of something. If we stopped at a winery or cider producer on the way back, you know, we just got a case of something that we wanted, we can bring it in and sell it. It's a fantastic luxury to be able to have. Everyone knows comes to D.C. and they're drooling over the fact that we can do that.
A lot of the small producers are afraid to enter into contracts, right off the bat, and so a lot of times that limits what comes into a city. And I'm a big proponent of going through distribution when you can, but one of the beautiful things is that you can take a small producer that's not sure about the market, not sure about the distributors, and they can come in and sell a limited amount of product in a venue that they really like, and then they can work out the relationships with distributors and come in on a more permanent basis. And so we'll get to do that with Cider for sure.
Let me ask you, so the rest of the DC scene, so you worked at Meridian Pint.
I worked at Church Key, Meridian Pint, Pizzeria Paradiso, Smoke and Barrel. Cooper's currently at Meridian Pint, and Tim ran the program with me at Meridian Pint and is now the beverage director of Boundary Rogue. So between the three of us, we've seen the DC beer scene for sure.
Cool. And then what's the tie-in with Kyle here? So talk about ciders in that area.
So I think we've been friends with Kyle for a while.
Sure.
I want to say
almost
three and a half years ago.
When we first entered the market, I think Greg Jasker introduced me to you guys. Ever since then, Sam's always had a huge interest. I think, for instance, since I'd known him, he wanted to start a cider bar. So I think it took a little while, but now his dream's coming to fruition. So he's always had a keen interest in interesting things going on in the scene, which has kind of fostered our friendship, I think.
GNK, are there we know about some of the Virginia cider scene. Is there much else going on in Maryland, cider wise?
Not a ton.
I think you're one of the first. Are there other small ones?
There's two other ones in Maryland.
Distillery
yes. Lane, which has its own orchard, and then what's the other one? I'm blanking out.
Oh, the something Shoals.
Yeah, Great Shoals. They do like fizzy cider and champagnes and stuff like that. Nothing too interesting stylistically. Mm-hmm. And then Virginia has a huge burgeoning scene. I think they have like 14 different producers.
Yep.
More and more opening up. So, I mean, and at the same time, though, what we're doing in Maryland is, I think, very different than what almost any cider maker is doing. You're seeing more ciders doing this kind of rustic style up in New York, especially as I come to West Side, I like to try some of these new rustic ciders popping up. But, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of more and more cideries doing this because, unfortunately for me, when you're doing apple-centric ciders, which are generally using sulfites and champagne yeast, yes, they're interesting, but I don't think there's the same amount of variation for varietals in apples as there is for grapes. And it's just a massive difference in grapes. In apple varieties, it can be very different, but if you're using sulfites, using champagne yeast, and just preserving the apple varietal, as if that's the only thing that's being produced by, 200 makers in America, you'll reach a limit on what flavors you can kind of really portray to kind of go to the next step and say, well, what does our area taste like? And start using the native yeast in your area. We've noticed great success not only fermenting with the native yeast, but getting it from organic orchards so they're not using pesticides or herbicides and killing off that microflora that's there. We just brought our Ford cider down for the tasting with Wassail. And just really cool, interesting, crushed flowers and just, like, this blue cheesiness that came along with it. That's just beautiful and indicative of the area that we live in. Hopefully, that'll kind of happen. So I was sitting with the new cider maker, or one of the new cider makers for Angry Orchard yesterday, and he was like, it'd be great if there was, a Maine style of cider, and a Virginia style of cider, and a Maryland style of cider, and a Washington State style of cider, and hopefully that's where the cider market's evolving to.
Well, John Bunker, when we talked to him the other day, and he gave a talk at Wassail as well, he really does feel that there are emerging cider styles throughout the country here. And he said, he very specifically said, terroir is important and styles are starting to emerge and that it's very exciting.
Yeah, I think the apples have it, and they've known it all along, and it's just us humans that are figuring it out.
Exactly.
Getting to know it and discern it, but I think it's there. It's just terroir.
Yeah.
When I say just terroir, I know that's sacrilege, but yeah. Terroir
We've seen already a difference between Finger Lakes, cider producers, Virginia, kind of everywhere that's having a cider week seems to definitely have their own styles based on climate. The indigenous apples,
just how the fruit is grown in that specific region.
So true. I mean, defining styles right now in cider is an extremely difficult task, and I have a rough matrix of what's evolving, but one of the nice things is there doesn't need to be any defined styles right now. We're all just discovering cider across America. All the producers, they're saying, where do we wait? How far can we push it? What
before
can we
it's
do?
Not cider anymore.
Yeah, before it's not cider anymore. We definitely push our cider pretty darn far. And one of my projects, I want to make a sherry cider where I take ice cider, get up to about 15% ABV, then put a floor over it. So I make a traditional fino style with the cap and everything. Why? Because why not? That's just let's see what cider can do.
Yeah,
So
you guys, you got some worthy companions over. I'm looking at this. So you got Tim, Sam, and Cooper from Ancho, and I'm looking at you guys. Deep thinkers here. Meridian Pine. You guys are like, so the core of like DC beer. I'm kind of amazed, impressed. I didn't know what you were going to be when you walked in. So yeah, just one of the fun things. Let's have more of this one. I actually say I'm partial to the male.
Yeah, for sure.
The Vasa Juan. I'm gonna just.
I prefer that one as well.
Yeah, they're totally different.
When we were with the producer recently, he pointed out that this product will get phenomenal with age, whereas Vasa and Dares should really be consumed fresh. So actually, both of these bottles are from my private collection, and I think these are from 2011, so they do have a decent amount of age on them, which might be why the Bosch and Bear has a little bit more of the phenolic funk to it, because it should be consumed fresh, but this is really at its prime right now.
So in the beer-centric places you've been working, do they have a cider component? Is that how you got turned on to it?
So yeah.
Meridian Pint only does American products, so we didn't discover the international stuff there, per se, but we started to explore more and more into American cider, particularly the ciders from Virginia, like Foggy Ridge, Albemarle.
Well, that's how we got to know Kyle, because we sold a ton of his cider and started bringing it in, and then that's how our relationship started. So we were selling, I don't want to say a lot in volume, but a large swath of your products, because there's not really much that tastes like it at all. I mean, not much. There isn't anything that tastes like it in Virginia, Maryland, or anything. So we wanted to, you know, definitely seek out and have relationships with people that are making interesting products like that.
Great, man. This is an awesome start. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
In 1996, L. Knife & Son acquired Union Beer Distributors, which was originally located on Union Avenue in Brooklyn, but has since expanded to its present location alongside the English Kills Canal in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Union Beer has grown dramatically in the last decade as the primary distributor of Anheuser-Busch products for Kings County, Brooklyn, through the hiring and development of the best people in the industry. In 2003, Union Beer acquired a powerful catalog of specialty brands, which immediately positioned them as the craft beer supplier to accounts in Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, and Staten Island. Union perpetually tweaks their portfolio to maintain the highest level of stylistic breadth with the most coveted brands available. Through the highest possible level of service, outstanding salesmanship of the ultimate lineup of brands, and a paramount focus on education on all levels, Union Beer has solidified its position as the only source for the best selection of beers in the 14 counties of southeastern New York. For more information, visit greatbrewers.com.
Hey, 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 welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is a special Cider Sessions edition. I'm with Kyle from Millstone, Tim, Sam, and Cooper from Ancho, kind of the D.C., Maryland scene, and of course with our good friends Gay and Kay from United States of Cider. So we're just finished talking with Sam, who's worked at some great D.C. beer places like Meridian Pint. And tell us more about how you got into cider. What point did you really become obsessive and start collecting ciders from other countries?
I think to give credit where it's due, one of our brewer friends in Washington, D.C., Nathan Zinder, he's the brewmaster for Right Proper, which is one of the really true gems of Washington, D.C., he had heard about this product, Vasa Ha'un. I think he had tried it at
here, in New York.
In New York somewhere, he had tried it. And so he kept telling us the legend of this cider that we had to try, that, you know, he was into funky beer and we weren't. He just kept telling us that we had to try Vasa Ha'un. So it took us about a year to track it down, and then we had it and fell in love. And I think Cooper and I like immediately booked a trip to Basque Country. We went to Spanish Basque Country as well, but we went to Bordado, and for me, that's when the light really went on, that we were, you know, entering a really awesome industry.
So, what are some of the highlights of Basque Country? If I wanted to learn about cider,
I would say the food is probably the best food in the world. So that draws you in right away. And then the way it pairs with cider is just, you know, two of the best things you can find. They don't quite do cider in the way that Asturias, their neighboring region of Spain, does cider, in the sense that cider is like what you drink when you're in Asturias, like all the time. So we were when we went there, actually, we were a bit unfamiliar with when you were supposed to drink cider and what, you know, what was the custom in Basque Country. So we were just going out to every bar and ordering cider, and people were like, "This, you're crazy. You're not having the cider with food. You're supposed to drink this earlier on while you're eating pinchos, which are their form of tapas, which are skewered individual bites, which will be featuring heavily on our menu. But the way that they, in Basque Country, you go to the cider house to have a large meal and just drink cider all day with whoever you're, you know, whoever you choose to go there with, or you can go by yourself, and there are tons of people there. You just make friends, and it's kind of an awesome, unique thing that you can't find anywhere in the States. And nothing like it, honestly. I mean, anywhere in the world, for that matter. But.
Well, it's cool. Cheers.
Cheers.
So now we're drinking one of the Millstone. Kyle, tell us about this.
So this is Citra Americana. It got its name because I was originally distributed by Rowan here in New York, and I remember they were going on about Citra de Nava, which was created by Virtue Cider, and they're like, "Oh, they're not using, you know, Spanish fruit. It's not a real Citra." And I was like, "All right, well, I'll just call mine Citra Americana. Be happy." So and I love the name. I think it's hilarious. It is all American fruit. Fermented with apple skin. So what we do is we work with our presser, who peels apple skins for pie makers. So we get just a big bin of skins. We throw it into our fermentation tank and ferment the cider 100% wild yeast along with the skin. So just tons of skin contact. Doesn't provide a lot of tannin the way grapes do. It does more of like this rounded mouthfeel. And it allows, for whatever reason, we don't even know why, but a light acetic quality to develop even in an anaerobic environment, which is why I think a lot of the Spanish ciders, even if they aren't seeing much oxygen, are getting slight acetic qualities, because a lot of the producers will ferment for a day on the macerated pumice. So, once again, we took an American-style process, Americanized what the Spanish were doing, and Citra Americana, it is a funky, lightly acetic, still style cider. Not much tannin to it, but definitely some funky, cool undertones. I really like it. And when we were working with the for the Ancho Cask collaboration, we talked back and forth, like, what style do you guys really want to see represented here? And they had acquired this awesome 660-gallon cask. What was in the cast prior?
Barolo
wine. And they're like, "Hey, we're not going to be opening for 8 months. Do you want to play with the cask?" I was like, "Yes, of course I do." I called my girlfriend up, and I'm like, "Hey, I think I'm sleeping with the cask tonight." You've been replaced. But so we used a lot of that skin.
And that's why it tastes so funky.
So we did a lot of that skin contact fermentation in that blend as well. We also used a lot of our ground harvest apples, which is extremely traditional. Almost all Spanish producers do ground harvest. So it falls from the tree, it hits the ground, it maybe bruises up a little bit, gets a little bit of rot, but that helps kind of provide this cool, funky flavor, deep, earthy qualities, maybe cheesiness. And we did a blend of, I think it was 11 barrels for the final thing, and blend it all up. It's aging in the cask right now. I was actually bringing a bottle of it for this, but I broke it on the way here, unfortunately. So Citra Americana is slightly indicative. I tried to go for a little more earthiness, a little more tannin in what they're producing, as well as a little bit of oxidative quality, because I like the idea of like a slight sherry influence as well, just because, you know, everything's Spain. Let's do something. And eventually, we'll see how it's developing. It's actually developing to the point where I don't think it needs any addition of wood, but maybe some Spanish cedar would be a really cool way to finish it off.
So you said these are all American apples and Citra Americana. Getting back to Citra Americana, a little bit away from the cascale. Do you use only apples from Maryland? Do you use from neighboring states? Do you import any apples?
So we're,
what's your fruit story?
So we source everything within 150 miles for everything we do, other than, you know, bottles and barrels and stuff like that. We mostly work with PA apples for the most part. We have our own orchard, which is about 3 acres. It's all pretty much a defunct fruit orchard that hasn't been used in about 20 years. So to fight off all of the bugs and the kind of diseases that are in the air, Maryland, it's almost impossible to do organic because it's so humid down there. So this orchard, as been forced to fend for itself, and you go into the supermarket, you see big, beautiful, red, delicious apples. This orchard, now they look like crab apples. They've been forced to gnarled, ugly crab apples, amazing for cider. They've increased their tannin and acidity to fight off the local bugs. So this is just, it's been part of our kind of like forage product. We're also working with a couple other local orchards, and there's one organic grower in the state that we work a little with called Country Pleasures, and we're actually going to be, we've been making cider for him as well, so he will be another one on the scene making some really cool cider. We pretty much made his batches for this year, but he will be making everything from his organic orchard next year, and he's obviously following the Millstone mindset of funky and weird and off the wall stuff, so I think his stuff's going to be really awesome. I'm really excited for what he's going to be bottling. And then PA, where we get the majority of our apples, Brown's Orchard and then Peter's. Biglerville is like the apple growing mecca of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania, I think, is the fourth largest grower, and everything is grown in Biglerville. So we're lucky to be that close, because you know, you really have to go to those places to find the interesting apple varietals. I remember I tried to get apples from Maryland originally, but I called everyone within 150 miles. I think I called about 200 places, and of all of them that got back to me, five had the apples in quantities that I was looking for. So it's still very difficult to find it. We generally have lower tannin apples just because, A, generally southern apples are generally lower in tannin. Also, just not many growers in our areas have high tannin. Though we've recently accessed some stuff like Northern Spy, which is prominent in like our Farm Gate and our Heirloom X. But one thing we've been finding with higher tannin is when you're going completely bone dry, sometimes that high tannin, that like candied apple caramel flavor, doesn't work with the high funk quality. So I'm actually been, despite having access down to Northern Spy, I'm actually lowering the amount that we're using because it just doesn't work stylistically for what we're trying to make. And at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you go up to Vermont, you talk to Steve Woods, he's like, you want high tannin apples, blah 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 blah. But it doesn't really matter. It's about what style do you want to make. And for the style we're trying to make, actually generally lower tannin, high acidity apples work really great for emphasizing that funk. Yeah, so what's in this variety is Stamen, Winesap, and Jonathan. Stamen has a little bit of tannin, very little. Has a really nice earthy feel to it. Jonathan, one of my favorite apples that we work with, high acidity, really portrays nice funk elements, as does Stamen. Just the workhorses in a lot of our products, like Farmgate, any of the earthier, funkier products. And then we have brighter products like Ginger Root, Rhubarb, Cobbler, that are generally featuring brighter apples like Gold Rush, like York Imperial, Cameo, Winter Banana, stuff along those lines that are, have really bright fruit characteristics. So everything we do is monovarietal, single varietal fermented, and then we blend after aging. We started as simple as possible, literally just fermenting all these different things, and we kind of discovered how these things kind of evolved and changed through the aging process, what each apple did, where it wanted to be placed. And we generally, we were blending 7 to 8 different apple varietals per cider in the beginning. And now we've, we kind of had a light bulb moment where we were like, hey, let's just figure out what pair like with like. Let's do 2 to 4 different apple varietals for any cider we make. Do it a certain quantity. So we'll blend, say, between 20 and 30% Stamen, Winesap, and Farmgate. And that's kind of our metrics now. But past that, it's like finding apple varietals that enhance the other flavors or the style that we're looking for.
Let's ask any of the Ancho guys, do you want to say anything about flavor profile on the Sidra Americana?
It's interesting because it has a lot of the high acid quality, like the Spanish Sidra, like the Asturian cider or some Basque cider would have. But also, as you can tell, that there's oak influence on it, new oak. And that's definitely a signature of a lot of the Millstone ciders, because they're doing all oak fermentation, all smaller barrels. So you get a lot of oak in it. So it's interesting kind of blending that new oak character with a little bit of an old world style of cider. So I think that's part of what Kyle was talking about before, the Americanization of certain styles of cider and different projects that people are undertaking of putting American influence or twists on old styles, which you see in beer everywhere now, and what sort of American brewers are known for, taking the old and putting the new spin on it.
Well, I'm impressed. I can't wait to try out Ancho. So tell us a little bit. I feel like D.C. is kind of like New York, unlike other cities, because it's like scenes are just evolving, the new cider scenes, you got some beer. Tell us a little bit about the D.C. scene, places that you guys like.
I guess I'll start with Right Proper, which I mentioned already. Right Proper is a brew pub that opened in the northern part of the city, I think, 2 years ago, and they're making just really fantastic farmhouse beers. I think Nathan's one of the most talented brewers I've met, and they're actually, they've had so much success that they're about to open a production facility with the intention of producing only for the district. So it's, for me, I think that's a really cool aspiration to have all this success and get this big brewery and then turn around and have the, you know, the intention of just selling within the city. I think that's a really exciting business model. But that's one of my favorite places. Cooper, do you want to talk about?
Where else would we like to go? Beverage-wise, well, I like to drink a Paradiso from time to time. They're always bringing great breweries to the market, do great events. Also, while Sam was there, he helped bring in more cider there, so we're seeing lots of Millstone on draft, which I typically go there to enjoy. Meridian Pint, we bring on Millstone fairly often as well, so, I mean, I work there, but I like to drink there as well.
What's like the service vibe in the city? I mean, I've been to like Church Key. I think it's you do a lot of the sample sizes. You know, tell us about how you anticipated Ancho serving your ciders. You know, portioning, your general vibe about it. Is it just everyone comes and pours their own tap? Is it a fine bottle list?
I think the general public in D.C. is starting to want something that's a little more higher brow. I don't mean like linens and formal service, but I mean better education and more informed service.
More serious.
Yeah. So the opportunity for places like Church Key or Ancho or wherever else that want to do events that are based around not just, you know, I remember, I'm sure in New York, like glass giveaways were a big thing too for a while. And like after a while, you start to think, you're like, it's really funny that people flock to bars to get a free pint glass.
It costs 30 cents.
Right. Yeah. And so I'm really excited about the opportunity now to do events. I mean, one of Tim's specialties is pairing. And so one of the things that we're going to do a lot of is having not just pairing events, but daily pairings. So if you're a neighbor and you come in every day, you can experience cider through a special that's seasonal and meant to be paired with what you're drinking, which is really, to me, the best way to drink cider. So this trend that's happening in both the beer world and in DC scene is something that really works really well for our goal of presenting cider differently.
Another example of an awesome place that we like to drink in DC that I can't believe I forgot about on that question, but the Mockingbird Hill, it's the only sherry bar I can think of in this entire country. I don't really know if there are any others, but I wasn't really familiar with much sherry until I went there, and they sort of do a great job of educating just novices that have never even had a glass of sherry in their life. And they have flights set up, you know, a beginner one to like introduce you to some of the basic styles that might be more approachable. And then they take you through with they have another flight after that that you kind of get more into the complexity of sherry. And then just, I mean, honestly, I knew nothing and came out of there feeling like I knew more than most people.
I love sherry, but I don't think there's anything more obscure than a sherry bar. And yeah. So when we saw someone
cider bar, not as bad as a sherry bar.
Well, it made us feel a lot better about, you know, pursuing our dream of a cider bar. If the sherry bar is working.
Yeah, you've inspired me. I want to run out and open a sherry bar right now.
There's a great one down in D.C. Check it out.
I'll tell you, 10 years ago when I opened this place, in New York, I didn't even think there was room for just a beer bar.
Yeah.
Because New York amazing is such
it's like, you know, cocktails, wine town, so... Hey, talk about service, glassware. What kind of glassware are you going to have?
I'll let that's Tim's.
This is a great question because this is all stuff that we're figuring out right now. I mean, even previously talking about how we're going to serve. These are philosophical questions that I think we're grappling with, not struggling with, but grappling with right now. Going to Wassail and seeing how they do it was definitely informative and interesting. Glassware is going to depend on the style of cider that you're drinking. I think for most cider, we're going to do something like a small white wine glass. I tend to like the way that they look. They're clean. I don't like having a ton of different glasses behind the bar, having different glasses just for the sake of having a ton of different kinds. I like the utility of a wine glass. For the Spanish cider, we're going to have the glassware that's specific to, pardon me, how they serve cider. So it looks like a tall, double-fashioned glass. It has a little bit of, it gets a little bit wider towards the top. They have paper-thin walls, and they'll use those to pour. The glass probably holds 6 or 8 ounces, but you only pour about 1.5 or 2 ounces in it at a time. The reason for that is there's very high acidity in their cider, and they're still, without carbonation, pouring them from a height. They generally pour them from 5 feet, 4 feet, whatever that is, it gives it a little bit of a carbonation to it, a little bit of a natural prickle, which will dumb down a lot of the acidity and bring out more fruit flavor. So it's not one note acid. It gives it a more round, fruity flavor. So that's something that we're talking about. Are we going to pour cider from 5 feet high and make a mess of our floors every day? Are we going to do a once a month type event? And if you go to bars in Asturias or in Basque Country, the way they don't drink draft cider, they drink cider out of a bottle that the bartender pours for you 2 ounces at a time. There's no such thing as 8 ounce glasses, because all that delicate carbonation you get from pouring at a height will go away in a matter of seconds. So you drink it quickly all in one gulp. So these are questions that we're grappling with right now, which is, for me, part of the fun aspect of opening a bar. Yeah.
That's great, man. Wow, we're going to cover some cool territory here with Ancho and Millstone on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll be back in a few minutes. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, this is a special cider session show with Millstone and Ancho, kind of D.C., Maryland scene over here at Jimmy's No. 43, and with Gay and Kay from United States of Cider. All right, so we're just talking about how they're going to do service and pours at Ancho when it opens in D.C. soon. But Tim from Ancho, you're also going to be doing some special pairings. Tell us about the program. I know you're working on it, but that's why it's exciting to hear about your thoughts.
So that's something that we're still figuring out. I know it'll rely heavily on cheese and cider, which I think go very well together. They're both farmhouse products. I mean, when they're done the correct way, they're both farmhouse-type products. The acidity in cider is particularly well-suited for cheese. I mean, I think any serious sommelier that knows really what they're doing around cheese, and you'll see this in a lot of books these days, is that red wine and cheese don't go very well together. You need white wine that's high acid or off dry white wine. And cider fits into that mold very well. It's often high acid. There's there's sometimes some sweetness, sometimes they're off dry or semi dry. And that's great for pairing with a broad range of cheeses. So I think that's something that we're going to feature prominently. Folks have, often heard of cider and pork going well together. Pork is delicious, so I would like to think we're going to try and put those together quite often. Our chef is, like many chefs are, obsessed with pork and things like that, and cured meat.
For good reason.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably worth it. We had a great time at Wassail last night, and it's been a while since I've been to a vegetarian restaurant. I really enjoyed the food, but that's maybe a big difference from between us and them, being a Basque-style restaurant. There will be meat in many forms. We'll be very vegetarian-friendly, but there will be a lot of meat.
For example, our pop-up that we're doing on the 27th, there's no vegetarian.
We weren't able to make it.
However, we will be catering.
So the dinner last night with Milson, what were some of the dishes that stood out for you guys and the parents?
The dishes, they were so esoteric, I don't think I could remember exactly.
Well, you spoke most of the time.
Yeah, and I still literally spoke most of the time and maybe ate like 4 bites of food, which was all delicious, but it was, there are like many ingredients that I can't remember. And just, I think if they don't win a Michelin star, then, that's a shame, because they're doing vegetarian in a really, really cool way and really just going all out with their Forge project and everything. So they're kind of taking the art form that a lot of especially in New York, the New York producers are doing with their Forge fruit and kind of enhancing that and incorporating it into how they serve their food, which I think is a really cool aspect of Wassail.
Do you guys remember any of the dishes from last night?
So we actually were unable to attend the dinner. We drove up here and couldn't make it in time for the dinner, which I believe it started at like 6:30. We didn't get up here till about 7:38. So, but we did eat a meal at the bar just from the regular menu, and it was pretty solid. So my favorite dish was the they had some cauliflower, which I believe was like, was it roasted or grilled? I can't remember.
It was roasted cauliflower. There was some black garlic in it.
Black garlic puree and a cauliflower puree underneath it with some baby mash and some cashews, I believe. And it was really tasty. I'm not much of a vegetarian myself, so I was pretty impressed by it. How much I enjoyed
it. I was impressed how often they were able to bring that umami element in that you normally get from protein through vegetables. In that case, it was like the black garlic, the fermented garlic, and just like such like that umami, the depth of flavor. And I was really pleasantly surprised by that. I thought they did a great job. And that was a note that I saw throughout all of their dishes. They even had like a simple bar snack. It was like jalapeno potato fritters. Tasted like they were like fried in bacon fat. You could have fooled me for sure.
They were.
Really, yeah.
Nothing like a good vegetarian dinner where it's cooked in bacon. I went to a dinner once and it was unbelievable because someone made like, you know, one of these things where she kind of like stewed the cauliflower in bacon fat and lard, then pureed it. So it was like this kind of like cauliflower like dip.
That sounds awesome.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
You can use it on your menu. Well, this is fun, talking about food and everything. But now we're tasting an Astoria cider.
Yeah, this is...
cider from Massachusetts.
close by in Astoria.
This one actually won best. So they have an Appalachian thing where they make cider just from Asturian apples. And you know, they have this whole certification thing on the bottle for all the products in Asturias that abide by that. By just using Asturian apples, and I think there were, 22 Asturian apple varieties?
Yeah, it's not just Asturian apples. They have to be native Asturian apples. So it's not just grown in the area, but they're heirloom varietals.
And this one this year, it's called Val de Bois, and it's from Castagnon, which is right on the outskirts of Gijón in Asturias. And that one actually won best cider in Asturias this past year. At the big competition there, which I can't remember the name of the competition.
It had won Best Cider Asturias the week before we got there, so we were pretty excited to drink a bunch of it, and we actually brought this bottle back with us. But this is an example of a product that really should be poured from height. So we've poured it out. It's been 5 minutes, so the flavor profile is not as intended. And one of the interesting things that we caught in both Asturias and Basque Country was that Americans have really grown to love these products while consuming them in a way that the Asturians and Basque would kind of laugh at. So allowing it to sit, it gets, I think, more acidic and funky, and it's much more akin to like the sour beer movement. If you go over there and you drink the way that they pour, which is, you know, from great height, it's way more refreshing and cutting and less acidic and less intense. And so they think it's funny that we like this cider this way. And I think at Ancho, I think one of the things that we'll get to do is allow customers to enjoy it either way. You know, I mean, who are we to say that you shouldn't like this if you like this?
So then how do they do it in Spain? I mean, do you sit at the bar and they keep splashing the 2 ounce
pour? You buy a bottle and you put it in front of you, but you're not allowed to pour it yourself. And this is in Asturias specifically, but the bartender's job is to pour you 1.5 ounces of the cider whenever you look at them.
And if you're sitting at a table, they have the servers essentially are the pourers for the floor. And they have these like portable, oftentimes they're portable, but not always. Sometimes they're stationary. But these things that kind of resemble like
a urinal almost.
Yeah. Yeah. And they put the glass down
into it. Yeah, say it again at the same time.
It's like, it's like a splash guard so that, you know, because even if you're pouring it completely perfectly, you're still getting some splash like onto the floor.
We're talking about pouring with your hand as high and as low as you can possibly go.
And these guys are pros. They don't miss. They look you right in the eye while they're pouring just to mess with you because they know you can't do it, and it's really frustrating.
Drinking cider in Gijón is one of the best cider experiences you could ever have, just because it's the only place where everybody is drinking cider all the time.
And cheers to Asturias.
Cheers.
We've hosted some of the people from Asturias over the years, and with the Rowan Import guys.
Yeah, this is their
I know
products.
A little bit about it. What I love is that it was explained to me that Asturias is like the one part of Spain that was never taken over by the Moors, and it's also like Celtic origin, mm-hmm. and it's all apples,
yep.
which we never think of as Spain. But this is so different from the Basque ciders. You know, this one at least also has like a saltiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a salinity to it. Yeah.
This one, it's closer to the Spanish Basque ciders than these French ones. These French ones are more like almost a hybrid of the sort of Spanish Basque technique and the more like the sweeter, more carbonated French ciders of like Normandy and Brittany.
Yeah.
But it definitely is its own thing.
So where else are you guys going to go to? You're going to travel far and wide?
Cooper and I actually went to England last month as well. We went to the Royal Bath and West Show, which is the largest cider competition in the world. And so we hung out in Somerset with all the English cider makers and drinkers, and that was awesome. I would really highly recommend it. Kyle, you have to go next year.
I will.
But they love American interest in their cider, so you become a celebrity the second you're there, and really fantastic. But additionally, we're also going to do upstate New York, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and Quebec in the near future. Then I'm also going out to Seattle to do a little Pacific Northwest tour. And then I'm never going to be able to travel again for the rest of my life, I think, and we'll open on
Normandy? Normandy's not on your list?
Normandy is on my list. That's going to have to happen after we open, and I haven't figured that out yet. That's the
I'll
one.
Go for you.
Yeah, I think Tim's going to have to go.
Well, so you, in England, so were there any ciders that you'll have on your list?
Yeah, so Tom Oliver at Oliver Cider and Perry is, I think they call him, do they call him the Prince of Perry or the Professor of Perry?
I think it's Professor.
Professor.
So his cider is really incredible. His Perry is out of this world. So we'll definitely support him a lot. Additionally, Borough Hill, you see their products infrequently, but as far as just like traditional medium English farm cider or dry farm cider, their stuff is really unparalleled, I think.
And then we had the pleasure of meeting Martin from Pilton Cider, Pilton is right near where they do the Glastonbury Music Festival. It's actually in the town of Pilton, well, on a farm right there. And he does a French-style Keeved cider that with English apples, and it's amazing. Hopefully we'll be selling that. We will be selling that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be an example of a product that if we don't have a distributor by the time we open, then we'll probably just direct ship it and bring it in.
I mean, England has such a strong, it's such a strong center of traditional cider that I think it would be a huge mistake not to, you know, carry a good portion of English. I mean, I think it's important to the story of cider, like West Country English cider is important to represent. And I think part of our goal is to show the story of cider on our beverage list. And I think that's something that's extremely important. You know, the French stuff, Brittany and Normandy, West Country England, Spanish cider, American cider, German cider, if we can actually find any that we can bring over. A lot of people forget that Germany actually has a fairly strong cider culture in it. It doesn't really get brought up at all, but hopefully we can change that.
Yeah, New Zealand too. There's some good ciders from New Zealand.
Gay or Kay, do you guys have any questions for the boys?
Well, I've already kind of touched on your cider pilgrimages, but I know there's something, I'm going to mispronounce it. Choach?
Yeah, no, that's right. Choach is right.
Yeah?
Choach is the, in the cider season in Basque Country or in Asturias, the barrels are full January through April. Mm-hmm. And so that's the time when you can go to the cider house for the choach. Mm-hmm. And it's, choach is, one, it's the actual pour out of the barrel. So they basically open a tiny faucet that shoots a tiny stream across the room and everybody runs to catch it with their glass. Mm-hmm. But it's also the entire experience. So the cider houses offer a typical meal that starts with like a bacalao or cod cake, and it ends with a massive bone-in ribeye. So that idea of the choach or the cider house experience is something that we want to replicate, one, through a festival that we would probably do in the spring to open our patio so we could spill cider all over the ground and christen the patio, but also something that we might offer more broadly as like a prefix menu on any day. You can come in and have the cider house experience. Or the choach experience.
So the cider actually just shoots out of the barrel continuously?
Yeah.
So it's everybody else's job to like, catch it and not...
You can line it up.
As long as there's line. And then they'll switch barrels every once in a while to like you go for a different... Some of them have a slight different flavor profile. You can definitely detect a difference between all the different barrels that they'll open the faucet on. But sometimes they're cheating, and we're not going to go into who does this, but they actually tap kegs and just have a fake little faucet coming out of a barrel that's sort of a facade for the old tradition. But a lot of them still do the real thing, I guess. But we would love to try and do something like that, but you know,
so
I don't kind know
of stand,
actually,
you stand in a line and just keep catching
right.
the cider
yeah.
as it comes, and you spill a lot. Too.
It's a bunch of grown adults running around like idiots, you know, lining up to catch, you know, 1.5 ounces of cider and waiting for their favorite barrel to get open and stuff like that.
Cidernalia.
Yeah.
I love the way you guys are thinking. This is kind of fun. Sounds like my kind of place. We definitely got to go down there. So, Kyle, we popped. So, here at Jimmy's number 43, we usually have at least one millstone. So, we have the Vin de Pomme. It's been here in our cold fridge a couple weeks.
Awesome.
How do you think it's showing? Is this the right temperature or do you like it warmer?
Generally, I like all of the cider shots that we do warmer. Just like sour beer, like rustic saisons. To get the full expression of what we created, generally you want to serve at least 55 degrees to maybe 65, a little on the warmer side. This is still, I think, a really nice expression of what it is. This is a focus on more Venice-style apple varietals. Two varietals that really stood out. This is definitely really my father's creation more than anything else. He really wanted to do something in the wine style. So it was a blend of Smokehouse and Grimes Golden. Aged for about a year on top of the lees, so it has like this slight champagne quality as well. We also were doing batonnage with this, so it's the stirring of the lees. It's done in wine a lot, and it helps create a rounder mouthfeel to the final product, as well as a bunch of other beneficial qualities to it. And I think it's showing really nicely right now. Good acidity.
So are these lees in the bottle? That's just because it was so cold.
Oh, there's every because of the minimal filtration, there's always going to be lees. Plus, everything we do is bottle conditioned, so there's dead yeast on the bottom of all of our bottles.
I think it looks pretty.
Thanks. One thing we didn't touch on is that right now, Ancho and Milson are working on, along with the cider. What's the guy?
Cider Guide.
Cider Guide are working on setting up a real cider festival in D.C.
Excellent.
So there's many cider festivals happening across the nation right now, but unfortunately they always seem to be kind of tainted, I'll use the word, that word, by some of the macro producers, and it kind of changes the script of, I think, what's trying to be so told about what real cider is. And the idea of this being we don't bring in, we're trying to say, you know, what is real cider? I think we're working towards that, but at the end of the day it might just be all off of taste. We'll be like, this is a real cider, this isn't. Sorry, but finding
it's
these
like porn, right?
Exactly. You know.
No, when you see it.
Yeah.
Porn, you know, or porn.
just doing something that really kind of changes the script and introduces people to what real cider is something that Ancho is all about, we're all about, and we want it to be international, just bringing in the coolest producers from all over the world, America, you know, Britain, Germany, New Zealand, wherever real cider lives, making them a part of the script and really doing it at DC, which is, you know, the hub of all of the melting pot that is America. And we think it's a great way of, you know, introducing this to an international community that's in DC. And hopefully it'll work out.
So, but where you guys are from, just tell me where you were born, since DC is so international.
Maryland.
Maryland?
Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Right down the road from Kyle in Baltimore.
Louisville, Kentucky.
All right, look how diverse that is. What about Kate? Where are you from?
I'm from West Virginia.
Oh, yeah.
West by God, Virginia.
And Kate, where are you from?
Washington State.
Wow, look at that. And I'm from Massachusetts. Look at that.
Apple growing.
Well, hey, there's always more to talk about on our Cider Sessions episodes. Thanks to our guests for sharing a taste of the Millstone Ancho collaboration and other Millstone ciders, and for sharing a bit about everything. Thanks again to Gain and Kay from United States of Cider to help me put the show together. I'd like to thank our sponsors at Union Beer Distributors, hope to bring this podcast to you today. Thanks to Kyle from Millstone, Sam, Tim, and Cooper from Ancho for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers and to our engineer extraordinaire, Jack Inslee. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Cheers. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.